Hi, everybody. My name is Lana, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Thank you, Kathy. I love you, too. Did you all think we were going to be late? I did. Dan was in charge of the vehicle tonight, so we're always right on the edge. I want to start tonight by saying thank you to the committee, the speaker committee for the June Jamboree, whoever it was, Terrence, I believe, that called and asked if I would speak tonight. It always sounds like such a good idea at the time, you know. And what's happened to me over since the time I talked to him is what always happens. I think of all of these wonderful things and all these wonderful experiences I've had in Al-Anon and all of those people who touched me, and just I have so much wisdom, and then here I stand and I don't know a thing. That happens to me every time. But something that I tell people when they're nervous about speaking is there's only one story to tell. And if we keep it that simple, if I keep it that simple tonight, I think this probably will come off okay. My husband and I were watching, Ringo Starr on TV on Larry King the other night, and he said always, still today, when he gets ready to go on and perform, he gets a stage fright that's incredible, and the minute he says a word or sings a word, he's okay. So I'm hoping that happens for me just any time. Would be good. I would like to start out just a little bit about where I came from. And before alcoholism, and I think sometimes, you know, we forget that there was a life before this thing. And I had a life before alcoholism came into my life, and I had a good life. I was a second child born in a non-alcoholic home. I have an older sister and three little brothers, whom I love all very much. And for the most part in our life, we've been able to stay very close. But there was never drinking in our home. Once in a while, at a special occasion, when my parents might have somebody over, or they might go out dancing or something, I would maybe see them have a drink, but I never saw drunkenness. It was totally foreign to me. I think that's why later in life I was so blindsided. You know, things hit me so hard. I didn't understand what was going on. I had nothing in my life to compare what was happening in my married life to my husband. So I was completely puzzled later in life, and I'll get to that point here in a minute. I was born in Missouri and have a lot of family that's still back there, and those are my roots. And I believe that my family today still lives by the things, you know, the where they came from. And one thing that I was, when I was little, was very much a tomboy. And the only thing that I ever remember crying for when I was a little girl was to get a horse. I loved horses. I dreamed of horses. And that's all that I really ever wanted when I was a little girl. Mom and Daddy were always home. Our family was always together. I had a very strong sense of security, but we were very poor, and I didn't even know that until maybe in the teen years of my life. I had no idea, because we did not need or want for anything when I was a kid. When I got to be a teenager and I got into the big schools, because I went to a lot of country schools, I then started to notice material things, but at that time it didn't matter. We didn't have a lot of outside friends, and the reason we didn't is that we moved all of the time. And the reason we moved, Dan and I moved a lot too, you know, but it was for altogether different reasons. The reason we moved a lot when I was little is so my dad could find work. And I would go to a school, I'd start to develop some friendships, and pretty soon we'd be uprooted and we'd go again. So I didn't make long-lasting, close friendships until I came to this program. I looked up to my older sister. I was, like I mentioned, you know, I was not real outgoing. My sister seemed to have that going for her, and she had a very large group of friends when she was in high school, and they lived around our neighborhood, and she was active in everything. She was in a choir at school and different things, and I looked up to her a lot, and so I hung out all the time with her and her friends, and so they were at least two, almost 3 years older than I was. And I hung on to her like glue everywhere she went. And, you know, I love her to death. She always took me along. And had it not been for her, I don't know, you know, where I would have been. But there was a time that it was the summer of my eighth grade year. I was attending CY Junior High School. And just gotten out of the eighth grade, I think it was the last day of school, as a matter of fact, and the local high school, NCHS, was having a end of the school year dance. And my sister made me a phony ID so I could get into this dance with her because I was too young. Prior to this time, she had been telling me about a boy in school, one of her classmates, and she talked about him a lot, and she would tell me, one of these days, I would like to see you meet this guy. I just think you would hit it off. I don't know why, but I think you would. And you know, she couldn't have been more right. I'm sure at that time, too, she didn't know just how right she was. But I think, you know, the point that I'm trying to make here is we hear some real unfortunate things sometimes in this program, and we get labeled a lot. And one label that does not fit me is that I was out looking for an alcoholic. I wasn't. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I didn't even know what drinking was. I truly didn't until I met my husband. But anyway, I was 14 years old, and she made me this pass to get into this high school dance, and lo and behold, we were there, and oh, by the way, Corey was playing that night. You've heard Dan's story, and I remember that night very, very well. He was playing in one of the really popular groups in town, and it was real I was so excited to get to go to something like that. Anyway, I was in there with my sister and a boy that was kind of sweet on me. It was her friend, but he kind of liked me, and I didn't like him. But he was kind of trailing around me, and pretty soon my sister said, hey, Lana, there's that guy I wanted you to meet. And so she introduced me to Dan. And he was also sweet on another girl that night, and had asked me to dance and was telling me about this girl. I noticed something that was different to me, but it meant nothing to me. In fact, I was a little bit impressed, to tell you the truth, but he was really drunk that night. He's really, really drunk. And I thought, gosh, what a neat guy this is, you know. He's nice and he's polite. And he drinks, and I'd never been around that kind of stuff. And so I didn't, you know, what would you think at 14 years old? I had no idea. And I know today that he didn't either. But anyway, we hit it off that night. And there was not only the drinking, but there was also a fight that broke out, and all kinds of weird things happened that night. But somewhere in the evening, I had given him my phone number, and I didn't put my name on it, you know. I just gave him my phone number. And the next day, I got a phone call from this soft, nice, soft voice, and he said, "Is Linda there?" And I didn't think that odd either. You know, Lana is not an easy name to remember, and I quickly excused that, and I said, "Is this Dan?" "Yeah." And I said, "Well, my name's Lana." And anyway, that's the night that we met. I was figuring today that that would have been 1964, 34 years ago. About last month would have been 34 years. We've been together since that night. Totally together. We went together. There were more of those kinds of parties, and there was more drinking, and you know, alcoholism being the progressive disease that it is, those were the days that it did not bother me. I did think it was exciting. I learned to drink with him. I got drunk a lot with him. We just had a good old time, and we were together almost constantly. And, you know, within a very short time, our parents were getting disturbed. Now I understand. I'm a parent, and I can see where they must have been at the time. But Dan and I were together all the time. He worked just up the street from my house, and in the summertime I'd fix him lunches and he'd come down, and that evening we'd get together, and we were just constantly together. Because we met so young, and other circumstances, we got married very young. I was 16 years old when I got married, and Dan was 18. He had just graduated from high school, and I quit high school when I was a sophomore. And we got married, and within a very short time, in fact, by the time I was 19 years old, I had my second child. So we learned to do a lot of living in a very short amount of time, too fast. And it was very hard. Alcohol was starting to interfere, you might say, with a lot of what was going on. We had a family now, and I certainly cannot stand up here and say that he was the irresponsible person in our family, because he was not. I was totally irresponsible, and did a lot of things in those early years that I regret today. I wish I had my two babies back. I'd do it different. I'm also full of emotion, I guess. Anyway, I remember very well, and we had not been married more than probably 3 years. But I remember sitting out, no, actually, that's wrong. We had not been married that long. It was after I had my first child. We lived in an apartment over by the high school that he graduated from. And I remember sitting out on the front step, watching my high school class graduate. And already, by that time, I was wondering where the hell we were going, what was happening. And I guess it was at that time that I started into what later was to become my own illness. Nevertheless, the partying, my partying too, went along for several more years. We began to move around. That's when all that started happening, and I've lost count now, but, you know, at one time I knew exactly how many times we'd moved, and it was astounding. We'd be in a place 3 months or 6 months or less than a year most times, and things would not be good, and we'd go, and we'd move back and forth. From Cheyenne to Casper to Missouri, back to Casper to Cheyenne again, and And I don't know how many places in Casper we moved. But I didn't know at that time that I was looking for something different, some kind of happiness somewhere. We had started to have some real difficulties from this drinking. It seemed to me at the time, and you have to understand that we Al-Anon people have no more idea what's going on than anybody else. We just know that something isn't right here, and what we see is the drunken behavior and the out all night, and you know the results of alcoholism is what we see and the consequences, and we don't know what's going on. The first time I made amends to my husband, I said that to him, and he said, "Lana, I didn't know either." And I believe that today, that in those days, neither one of us knew what was about to happen. We lived that way for the next 20 years. Anyway, I remember distinctly one night talking to my husband about having these two young children, and they had health problems, and having an adult conversation between us, not a fight, but an actual, you know, I think we need to do things different. I feel like we need to pay more attention to these children. They're sick. They had very severe health problems, and we need to kind of quit this party scene. We only go out once in a while. This every night stuff is not good for our family. And he agreed with me 100% that we needed to do that. We didn't like the friends we hung with. You know, he agreed with that. I've got to say that every time there was drunkenness in our home, there was a problem. Every time. We weren't the kind of people that could go out and have a few drinks and come home and go to bed and get up in the morning and go to work. And, you know, that's social drinking. And that's not what was going on in our home. I know today that that's what separates an Al-Anon person from an alcoholic. We are affected by the same disease, but we do not have the same illness. And we are thousands of miles apart in that respect. But alcoholism nearly killed my husband, and it damn near killed me. And, I can't stand up here and tell you all of the incidences. I don't have all night, but you've all been there in one respect or the other, so just kind of fill in the gaps, and chances are you're right, you know. Something happened at that point in my life. I see that was a turning point for me, and not for the better. It was a turning point for the worse, because I did stop drinking. I did what I said I was going to do, and did not. And it was at that point that we began to live this horrible, horrible life. I went through all of the familiar things that we hear, the chasing them down, finding them in the bars, looking them up, hiding the whiskey, pouring it out. I did all that crazy stuff, but that was in the early days. You know, that was in the early days, and it got worse for me. What happened to me at that time was that I went from a reasonable, semi-reasonable person. Another thing was my family. You know, I really had grown up with the fact that you stick together. You know, you stick together and you can work anything out. I can remember when I was growing up, no water in our home, and we took baths out in 55-gallon drums, and, you know, we enjoyed it, and it was tough, but by golly, you stuck together. And I had that feeling that, you know, we just stick together, everything's going to be okay. And it wasn't. And it wasn't getting okay. And he was going off different places. There were lots of those jails and lots of those cops and lots of money down the drain. trying to fix all of that kind of stuff. But the what happened to me today, I can identify what it was. Back then I couldn't, but I got into a tremendous amount of fear. And fear does one of two things to me. I don't know what it does to you, but I know what it does to me. It still does today. I either get very angry or I can't do anything. Those are the two ways that fear manifests itself in me. And that's when I got angry. I would like to stand up here and tell you that I was the good little Al-Anon wife that sat there and had the meals ready when he came home, and oh, poor me. I don't have that story. what I became was a maniac. And I used to stand up in my husband's face and put him down for this. And today I know that it took a hell of a man to put up with me. I started to go into rages. I would sit there and wait. And I want to emphasize this a little bit, because sometimes there's a lot of laughter about this kind of stuff. And unless you're an Al-Anon person, you don't understand maybe what I'm about to say. But we talk about peeking out the windows and pulling the blinds and listening for the cars and all of that stuff. And I'd like to touch a little bit on what happens on the inside of us. Anyway, this is what happened to me. I had two kids, no money, house being taken or whatever the situation was, no car. Him gone, he's been gone all day. Didn't come home again that night. The kids were crying because Daddy was supposed to be home. We were supposed to go somewhere. And they're scared to death of Mom because she's not exactly accessible right now. And when they would try to come up to me and say something, my rage would come out. And they got the brunt of all of that. Thank God, I can tell you, I did not ever beat my children. I never beat my children. But I just was not there for them. But I would lay there in bed, or I would sit up in the dark, and I'd pray to what I don't know. But I would pray, God, please see that he comes home safe tonight. Please help us. Help my kids, help me just bring their daddy home, bring my husband home. God, please do that for me. And I'd listen for the car. And then it wouldn't come. An hour or two later, I was sure that he was dead somewhere, He had to be somewhere dead, or he would have been home by now. What am I going to tell the kids if he dies drunk? What am I going to say? What am I going to do? And then pretty soon, I'm planning a funeral in my own mind. And then I'm bargaining with God, and I'm saying, God, if you bring him home, I promise I'll never fight him again. I promise I'll never do those things again. That's what was going on inside. Peeking out the window is just, that's nothing. But then he'd come home. And the minute that he would walk through the door and I would see that he was drunk, I lost total control of myself. And there were many times that Dan could have knocked me to the ground because I would have deserved it, and he didn't. Not to say that we didn't get in a few fisticuffs, because we did. But if he hit me every time I hit him, I probably wouldn't be standing here today to tell you about it. But that's where my illness took me in that time. And my kids saw a lot of that. They didn't see Daddy coming home. They didn't see Daddy drunk, or they didn't see the things that I saw. They saw me. And there have been many times that my children, little, have stood up and said, Mama, just leave Daddy alone. It'll be okay if you just leave him alone. And I couldn't do it. And I'd go to bed, and I'd be so... I don't even think there's a word for it. Desperate, despair. And he'd wake up in the morning and he'd have that look that we all know so well. And sometimes, you know, he'd accuse me of making things up. And I'd tell him what happened, and he'd say, that didn't happen, you know. And that kind of stuff really blew me away, because then I thought he was lying to me and expected me to believe him. I was there. And then pretty soon I'd think, maybe I wasn't there, you know. God, am I going crazy? That's what was happening to me. I want to tell you about one night in particular and then get on to more about what happened and what it's like today. I just, one night, many, many years ago, it was a long time before I came to Al-Anon, and why this one night always sticks in my mind, I don't know, but it does. But it was no different than any other night. I did the very same thing that I just told you about, and he came in and he had a bottle of whiskey. And I went for him, and we fought over the bottle of whiskey over the sink, and it broke. And the longer we fought and the more he fought for that bottle, the more insane I got. And my children woke up. They weren't very old. And I just screamed at them to get in the car. And they went out and got in the car. And this fight continued. And the only reason I let go of my husband's throat is because I heard my daughter scream. I think the reason this one sticks out is I was in an open AA meeting years later, and that's the first time I'd heard about blackout drinking. And I knew that... that was one of those nights, and there were many, but that one was a horrible one. Because the next morning, I hadn't slept all night, and the next morning I saw my husband go to the mirror in our bathroom, and he was holding his shirt down. And he couldn't recall if he'd been in a bar fight or what had happened to him. And at that moment, I thought, there's something very wrong. And you know, I don't know what it is. I think my kids were 5 and 7 years old that night. To get past this, that's how we lived. Later, I saw my husband in many jails, and I did the thing that I thought I was supposed to do, and I always went and got him. And every time I did, I just knew that's going to be the last time he ever does that. That's going to be the last time. I just know it. Anybody that, you know, that this happens to, I just know he's going to see it and he's going to stop, and he didn't. And it got worse. I saw him in a straitjacket one night. I had taken him to a hospital because something was desperately wrong. I found out later that it was alcohol poisoning. But I thought he was going to die that night, so I took him to the hospital, put him in a room behind bars, and put him in a straitjacket. And they sedated him. And I wish they would have done the same for me, because I sat out there all night long, desperately trying to get him out of that room, because I had done that to him. You know, today I know alcoholism did that. Anyway, several years later, my husband was, he was disappearing for long lengths of time. He would be, he was a salesman. He talks, and it's his story to tell, but the last 5 years of his drinking, he talks a lot about that. And I would have to say that was probably true with me too. The last 5 years of his drinking, the last 5 years before I came to Al-Anon, I had given up doing all of that stuff. You know, I would go to bed at night, and I'd pray not to wake up. Things like that scare me a bit. At least I didn't think I was ever suicidal, but when I think back on those days, you know, you just didn't want to live. And I told my mother one time, she and my father would beg me to do something with myself. They were so desperately worried. And they'd say, go to church. You know, your answer is to God. Go somewhere and get some help. And I looked my mother in the face one day with not a tear, with not anything, no feeling at all, except absolute sureness. And I said this to the mother that raised me, that loved me. And I just said to her, oh, Mom, what's the point? You know, heaven. But nevertheless, I gave up on everything. I didn't have the energy left anymore. I quit looking. I just existed, and I just did what was in front of me to do. If he was in jail, I went and got him. You know, if we had to move, I just passed. You know, I just learned to exist. And there was absolutely nothing else left in me before I came to this program. He ended up he had started disappearing for long periods of time, say sometimes a week, sometimes 10 days. He was a salesman at that time, and it took him away from our home. And my children were getting older. I think they were, I'm thinking 12 and 15 or 12 and 14 when I came to Al-Anon, I'm not real sure. But anyway, they were older than that. Anyway, doesn't matter. He was on one of those times when he was gone for a long time, and he called me one night and told me he was going to go to a hospital. And he'd been in many hospitals. But this night he said that he had talked to somebody at a hospital in Cheyenne. This was in November of 1983. And he said he was going to go, and he thought he had a problem with drinking, and he talked to somebody that understood. He was in, I think he was in Gillette or Rapid City or somewhere when he called. And the only thing that I had to say to him was, call me when you're sober, and if you want to go sober, I'll meet you there. And it took him a while to get there. He didn't go till January of 1984. But that's his deal, and I try very hard not to get into his story. It's a little tough when you're an Al-Anon to tell a story without mentioning an alcoholic. But anyway, in January of 1984, he went into a hospital, into a CAC ward, DePaul Hospital in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And it was January 8th, I'll never forget it. And I drove him there, left the pickup, and flew back that day. And what happened as a result of, that was the very first time, believe it or not, the very first time alcoholism had ever been mentioned to me. It was the first time anybody ever put a name on what was happening to my husband and to me. But one night when I went to their family week, I didn't get to have any contact with him. He was not to call or write or do anything for 2 weeks. I was stark raving mad. I had seen that man in a lot of situations. I had no idea what was going on in that hospital. You know, for all I know, I'd been in a straitjacket for that length of time. I had no idea. But 2 weeks passed, and he called me, and there was a difference in his voice. There was a big difference. I knew he wasn't drunk. I could tell that. I'd radar ears, radar nose, you name it. I could tell when he was drinking, and I knew he hadn't been drinking. And he said that he had found out a lot about himself. And, you know, when he first called, I was so happy to hear from him that I did the very same thing that day that I did, as I told you before. I was so happy to hear that he was alive. And the more he talked about how much better he felt, the more pissed off I got. And I thought I was going to go out of my mind. You know, and he said something to me that darn sure made me understand that he had been telling everybody about me down there, because he said that he found out I was sick. You know, Al-Anon has a pamphlet that said that it's called Understanding Ourselves and Alcoholism. And in there, it talks about alcoholism, a brief little deal on alcoholism. Then it talks about the Al-Anon person. And you know, we pick up on things that are not true, but we learn to believe them. And one of the things that I truly did believe was that this was my fault. That I was not someone he wanted to come home to. You know, that somehow, somewhere along the line, I had done something terribly wrong, and I just couldn't measure up, and this man would not come home. And I had that feeling about myself already. And when he said that they told him that I was sick, I thought, well, you so-and-so, you've been down there telling them all the things that I've been doing for the past 20 years, and if you had me, you'd drink too. And I was sure that that's what he had done. And he invited us to come up there. And what happened, I'm getting to the what happened part. What happened for me was, I was angry when I was there. I was not nice to these people. I wanted nothing to do with them. Kathy mentioned it when she introduced me. I had an armor. I had been inside myself for a very long time, and I was not about to show you who I was, and I wasn't going to show them. So one night when I was there, my kids were with me. They didn't know what to think. You know, they were as affected by this as I was, and we were all so glad to see Daddy. But that night, they said, we're all going to go to a meeting. He had mentioned this AA business to me, and I knew that those people had meetings. He told me that. And we walked down this corridor. I wasn't the only family member there. There were many. But the alcoholics went one direction, and I started to follow him. And this woman grabbed my arm and said, you're coming with us. And that's how I entered my first Al-Anon meeting. I believe today, the God of my understanding knew I would never, ever walk through the doors of Al-Anon on my own. I know that without a shadow of a doubt. I did not want to do that. I did not ask to do that. And I never would have. I still have difficulty with that today. I have to be honest with you. It's still very hard for me to reach out and tell you I need help. It's real hard. But I can do it because of you. But anyway, that night we get into this meeting, and there were all of these women sitting around. I think there was one or two gentlemen. My kids were the only kids that had gone. And they were sitting in there, and I tell you what, I thought to myself, if this is what Al-Anon is, no thank you. Because they were laughing, they were talking openly about this stuff to each other, they were even hugging a few of them, and the chairman, she just seemed to me to be nothing but a phony. And that was where my mind was. She's talking about all this wonderful stuff and God and, you know, all the things that we hear today. And I thought, no way. I had long since abandoned the God idea. I didn't want any help from anybody. thank you very much. And that was my attitude. They asked me if I wanted to talk, and I said, I do not want to talk, and neither do my children. And I'm just sure they were darn glad that I was there that night, you know. They got to see a little bit of how it could be. But something happened, and it taught me a lesson, and it's something I've never forgotten, and I hope I never forget it. And that's how much it means, how much this fellowship means to us. Because the person that was a chairman was Margaret from Cheyenne, and many of you know her. But she caught me before I could dash out the door. You know, she did what we're supposed to do. And she reached out to me. And she didn't have to say a lot, because there was something about the way she treated me, the way she looked at me. And I saw immediately that she knew who I was. I couldn't say that, but I knew that. And she looked me right straight in the eyes, and I couldn't look her back. And she said, Lana, why don't you do something for yourself? Do yourself a favor and attend an Al-Anon meeting when you get back to Casper. And I couldn't even say anything to her. I just listened to her, and she gave me a note, had a name and a number on it, and she said, please call this lady, and she'll see to it that you get to a meeting. This is for you. And nobody had ever said that to me. Nobody had ever said that to me. So I thought about that all the way home. And as soon as I got home, that was a Sunday, and as angry as I was, and as sure as I was I would never, ever reach out to anybody, I picked up the phone the moment I got home, and I called that lady, and that was Shirley. And they had meetings at their house, and she said, it so happens there's a meeting tomorrow night, Lana, and you can come to that one. I'll be there. It's in my home. And I went, with my head down. I had no idea what I was getting into. It's just that somebody said, this is for you. And it attracted me, and the look that she had in her eyes. And it's that look that we have between one another. But I went. That was in mid to late January of 1984, Monday night caring and sharing Al-Anon family group, 14 and a half years ago. And that's still my home group today. Thank God. I have to mention that two to three weeks after Dan was released from that hospital, he drank again. And he was to drink. And alcoholism was to progress to depths that I hope I don't ever have to see in my family again for the better part of the next 3 years. And had it not been for this fellowship, I do not know what would have happened to me. I just don't know what would have happened. But people wouldn't let me get away with this shield of armor that I had. One time a friend of mine, Patty S., she doesn't come around much anymore, but one time she called me and said, how are you, Lana? I said, oh, I'm just fine. And she said, you're not either, and I'm coming right out. I said, my God, don't come. He's drunk. Don't come, you know. I was still hiding. I'd go to the meetings, but I was still hiding what was going on in my home and how I was living and what was happening to my husband and my children and all of the other stuff, you know, the stuff that happens. But they didn't let me get away with it, and they loved me unconditionally. It did not matter what condition I came in. It didn't matter what I said. Didn't matter what I didn't say. They were just always there. And thank God they were. And thank God you don't have to meet certain requirements to be here, or I could not have stayed. I did not believe in God anymore. I didn't. I sure wanted to. but I didn't. And I knew that, and I was so humiliated and embarrassed by that that I couldn't speak. You know, when people would talk, they'd talk about how their higher power had worked in their lives and the God of their understanding and all of that stuff that scared the hell out of me. That first night I went into a meeting, and I was so inadequate. I felt so inadequate in that respect and so bad that I could not believe that I didn't talk in meetings for a long time. And when I did, it was bullshit stuff I would make up because I'd heard it somewhere else. You know? And that group saw me through hell and back for the next 3 years. I kept going, don't do what I do, please. But I did not get a sponsor for almost 2 years. For me, it took that long for me to have the courage to ask someone to help me. And even when I did, I wanted to back out immediately, but she didn't let me do that. She insisted I be at her house the next morning at 9:30 a.m. and I went. And my sponsorship in the beginning was a bit strange, I have to tell you, because I couldn't say anything to that woman. But I sat and listened. And she pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do that today with people I sponsor. And I use every Al-Anon book that there is written, and we have a lot of them. And we go through them all. But she insisted immediately that I learn about alcoholism, that I learn what I was living with and what I had lived through, and why those, some of those terrible things that I've mentioned earlier, why those things happened in our family. What happened to me as a result of that. I don't know how long it took, but sometimes I would have to write on paper, and that's how I communicated with her. The mere fact that I'm standing up here in front of you today is an absolute miracle, because I couldn't do it. If I get in a lot of fear today, I still have a tendency to go way down deep inside and hide, and I don't like to come out. Anyway, after some time and reading in the books, we started on the steps. And I'm going to tell you, that is when my life, in the worst stages of alcoholism in our home, my life started to take on a whole new meaning, an entirely different direction, and I started to find out who Lana was and who she was not. And there are some other things that started happening in our home. There weren't any more fights. Now, so, you know, we talk about spiritual awakenings and spiritual experiences in this program, and mine are really pretty simple. Very simple. One night it occurred to me, and you know, for me this means a lot. But one night it had occurred to me that I had not touched my husband or gone for his throat in quite a long time. Damn. You know, that was a big deal to me. Probably a hell of a big deal to him, too. But it was a big deal to me. I started to sleep on nights that he was gone. That's a spiritual awakening in itself. You know, little things that meant so much to me. And I started to see that things were different somehow. Nothing was different with him. In fact, it was worse. But something was happening with me. And even though he was still drinking, we started to have a little bit together. And that's because of the Al-Anon program. He had not been to AA yet, He knew about it, but he hadn't come here yet. And I'm a firm believer that I don't care if you're an alcoholic or you're an Al-Anon or you're an Alateen, once recovery starts in a home, things do begin to happen. And it may not be all at once, and it may that we can't count on that, but things just happen. This is a spiritual program full of spiritual principles, and things start to happen. They start to get better. And I started getting better. And she insisted that I start attending some open AA meetings so I could hear right straight from the horse's mouth about this disease. And I'll forever be grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for having open AA meetings. You taught me so much about my husband. So much that not even another Al-Anon person could teach me. It came from you. And I hope, you know, that you always welcome that person that comes in to try to learn what's going on. It's a lifesaver. It's a lifesaver. Anyway, we started through the steps. I've got about 10 minutes to sum this up. Step one, I've spent the better part of this evening telling you how I got to step one. You know, we walked back through my life, and what I've told you tonight, my sponsor knew, and she knew everything else. It's not up to me to stand up here and do a fifth step with you. But there are people in this program that know me very well, those that I have cared to share that with, know me very well. They know where I've come from, what I've done, what I'm ashamed of, everything about me. And I learned to do that. I learned to let somebody know who I was. And one night I was asked the question, and it kind of sums up step one for me, and why I'm powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. I don't think that should be a question in your mind right now about how my life became unmanageable. But she popped the question to me one night, Lana, did anything you ever did, do you think you did everything you could? I said, I think I did. I think I, by God, did everything that I could. She said, did any of it ever work? And by gosh, you know, no, it hadn't. Nothing had ever worked. And I understood what it means for me to be powerless over alcohol and alcoholism. I went into step two, and I told you I did not have a belief in God, and my only belief was that he worked in your life. And I could see that because you were sharing that with me. And the step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I wanted very, very badly to believe. And my sponsor said, that's all that's necessary. The big book talks about that in depth, actually, in the chapter to the agnostic, that all that's required is a willingness. And that's all I had. And we went right on to step three. And she said, okay, now are you ready to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him? Didn't understand him very well, but I had to. You know, it was not a question anymore of whether I wanted to do this or not. For me, I had to do it. I was terribly afraid of what would happen if I didn't. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And at that point, that had to be everything in my life, including my husband, including my children, including all the damage and the wreckage, including what might happen in the future as a result of this. I had to do that. And then we went into inventory. And I got to take an honest look at Lana for the first time. Something that happened for me, and I think it's worth mentioning, and a lot of the people that I've sponsored have had this same thing happen. I thought I had so many resentments towards my husband, and I did at one point. But because my sponsor cared enough to help me learn about alcoholism and to put me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and take me to open AA meetings and to put me where I needed to be to find out about this disease, I had very few resentments toward my husband by the time I got to the fourth step. There were some things, of course, that I had to put on there, but so much of it had been healed because of the knowledge and the understanding that I had gained from you. There was finally an answer. There was finally an answer to what our dilemma was in our family. And I did the fifth step to the very best of my ability. I've done many, many of them since that time. Went on to 6 and 7. I spent that hour and I got on my knees and I said, God, please take from me these character defects. You see, those nights, a lot of those nights that I laid in bed awake all night because he had been out drinking, I found out through the process of these steps that many of those nights I laid up awake feeling so damn bad for what I had just done. And I asked God to take that anger and to take that fear and my reluctantness, all of those things, the character defects that I saw out of those steps, and I asked him to take those from me. And he's taken a great many of those things from me, a great many of them. Some of them I can snatch right out of the air. But I'm not the same person as I was when I came in here. We went on to an 8th step, and we went back to the list that I'd made in my 4th step, and I got to look at those people I had hurt, got to add a few more that I didn't have resentments toward, but that I darn sure owed amends to, like my children. And we went about talking about that list, and I think that's a very, very vital step. Because by that time, I was feeling the life and the energy that we finally get to feel in this program and the love and all those things. And I wanted so bad to go out and make everything okay. You know, I was sorry for living. I had been the worst person, you know. And we talked about those a lot. And there was one thing that she said to me before I went out to do my amends. And she said, are you absolutely sure you have this in your mind, what you are going to do? Are you absolutely sure that you're going to carry this out? And I said, absolutely. I have got to do this. I can't stand it anymore. I've got to go make these amends. And she said, the reason I ask you that question is there's a hell of a difference between an apology and an amend. You have been apologizing your whole life. But when you make that amend, you are going to be willing to give that up and to never do that again. Now, I'd like to say that I lived up to that. I didn't. But there are so many things that I have done in my life that I have never had to repeat again. I've never had to do them again. And that's fifth step stuff. But that's the difference between an apology and an amend. You know, an amend means absolutely nothing. To make amends to my children for the way that I was not there for them, to go up and make this, sincere amend and then abandon them, emotionally? No. I had to start paying attention. You know, I had to start being there for my children and carry through with what I said I was going to do and be a mother to them. I had made amends to my husband and I've not had to repeat the harm that I did to him. Because my sponsor was very serious about these steps, and if you didn't want to do them, she's not going to mess with you, you know. And the 10th and 11th steps, and I'm got to cut it short here. You know, to take that daily inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Turn my thoughts to somebody else. I did that today. I was fearful today. This has been a very hard year for me. I'm going to tell you that right up front. It's one of the hardest years I've put in my life. So I was afraid tonight. And I spent the whole day reaching out to other people. And God removed my fear. You know, I asked him to. I talked to somebody else about it. I did what the step requires. When I got up this morning, I asked God to direct my day to come into my life and be with me every step of the way today. And then the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, I miss very few Monday night meetings. And I go many times for need for myself, but I go for another reason also, and that's because I believe that we need to be there like that woman was for me that night I walked out of my first Al-Anon meeting. And there are very few times that I will let a newcomer get out the door without making some kind of contact with them. Or at least things that somebody does. It's been, sponsoring people has been the absolute highlight of my life. And as we all know, they do for us far more than we ever do for them. But to be able to share our experience, strength, and hope, like I've done with you tonight, or at least I hope I've accomplished that. To be able to sit down with someone else and have them to look down at the table and not be able to make eye contact with you. Kathy and I went through that. As well as most people that I've sponsored, most women. For them not to be able to look you in the eye, they can't tell you what the problem is. They just know it's horrible, and if there's anything like me, they don't even have words left anymore to talk about it. You know, and to see that same person go through this wonderful journey in these steps and come out, you know, to watch this happen in their life. There's nothing in the world like it for me. One last thing about this last year. There are diseases out there other than alcoholism. Many years ago, probably 12, 13 years ago, in my Monday night meeting, there was two women, a mother and a daughter, that walked into our meeting. And you know, at that time, there was some stuff going on that, you know, I have to question today. I've learned from it, and I look back on it. But there was a lot of this is this, and this is that, and by God this, and by God that. And these two women walked in one night. And they said, you know, we don't know where to go. But we have, my son is a drug addict. And we don't know where to get help. Should we come here? And they walked up to me and said that. And I know the traditions. I know them very well. But it was beyond me to be able to say, no, you don't belong here. And I said, I'll tell you what, you sit in our meeting with us. This is a meeting of Al-Anon, and we come here to recover from the effects of alcoholism on our lives. But I said, you come here, and you decide if this is for you. There's nobody here going to tell you, you have to go. Well, I'm so glad that I did that. A couple weeks ago, the sentencing has been switched. And those of you that know me and know this, it's the end of July now, so we still have a long wait. But I have a little brother that will be sentenced to federal prison for an undetermined amount of time. We don't know yet. because of his addiction and where it took him. And I love him very much. And because of you, I have the most wonderful relationship with my little brother. Better relationship with him today than I've ever had in my life. He writes me at least once a week, and I write him. He writes beautiful poetry. He just doesn't have a lot to do there, you know? So he sends me these things. And I would be forever grateful that I can love him just the way he is, unconditionally. He's never disappointed me. He's never let me down. And his disease has taken him a long ways. But it didn't kill him. And so I'm grateful for that. Don't ever, you know, be careful what you say to people, because it may come back to haunt you. And I'm very glad that night I could welcome those ladies, because I've had to share that a lot in my Al-Anon meetings, to get past it and to move on and to be of help to my parents and the people around me. Again, thank you very much for inviting me to speak tonight. I love you all very much. When I walked in here, a friend of mine said, "Don't worry, don't be scared. You know, we all love you." But I love you. I love my husband. We have a life together today that's been given back to us because of these two programs. I could go on and on about how grateful I am, but it's time for him, and don't want to go any further. So thank you very much.